Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Paula Faust, who is the director of a film called Origins of Yoga. Right now, I would like to welcome Lance Fung. He is the curator of Site Santa Fe's biennial exhibition, which is called Lucky Number 7, and which opens to the public this Sunday, the 22nd of June, from 12 to 5. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure.
It's great to have you here. Now, Lucky Number 7 refers to the fact that this is the 7th biennial at Santa Fe, at Site Santa Fe. When you were given the opportunity to curate this show, how did you approach it? I mean, it's a tricky thing, I would think, when you have the whole entire world of art to choose from. You had no limitations. Where did you begin?
Well, for me, what I wanted to do was look at the background and history of Site Santa Fe itself. So I think that the main inspiration came from the institution itself, the board members, the leadership, and also the pre-existing biennials. So ultimately, what I wanted to do was partner a site with many other institutions from around the world so that we could really explore the international aspect of the biennial.
And so, as you said in your essay, you weren't really curating artists as much as you were curating institutions. What do you mean by that? That's such an interesting concept.
I think it's confused a lot of people, so it is kind of interesting. I spent the first year looking at institutions all around the world, seeing which institutions had a very strong educational program, were really community-orientated, who were primarily non-collecting institutions. And based on their merits, I then invited them to be part of the biennial. So that was phase one.
And so these were all non-profit institutions, or such as their versions are in other countries?
Absolutely. 18 of them, from Cairo to Istanbul, Beijing, all around the world. It's been an extraordinary traveling, going around for 2 years, looking at all these institutions and meeting with people and dealing with language barriers and whatnot. But in the same goal of finding people who are really passionate about the visual arts.
Now, something that I've been told by different people, I do not, like you, get to jet around the world and see what the art scene is like in different places, but to what extent is it globalized in the sense that the aesthetics and the ways of working and the themes that people are dealing with are really similar from one big city to another? And how much of a regional identity is there in different places?
Well, I think that's an interesting point. Definitely, there is some form of globalization within the visual arts. Magazines, internet, and this very easy, quick flow of information can affect how an artist approaches their work in the studio. However, what I was trying to find was, through these institutions actually, were artists who were a bit more grounded and were less focused on the international art world. And by finding these curatorial partners, I then invited them to propose five artists, or up to five artists, of who they felt most embodied their spirit, the energy, the mission of that institution, hoping that these institutions would each have some retention of their local culture, their energy, because the art scene in Beijing is totally different than the art scene in Cairo. But yet they all get Art Forum and Art in America and what have you. But what actually exists in their institutions, how their audience reacts to the show, is totally different. So even though there's a globalized way of looking at art, and most biennials try to either be super cultural or global, both of which I think are a trap, I thought these institutions would be able to pick artists who are really grounded. And by finding artists who are grounded, which I think I've done, 25 from all of these different countries, they're able to incorporate who they are, whether it's an ethnic issue, a cultural, age, religion, race, what have you, but it's authentic. And I think through each individual's approach, there is this varied cultural experience, but it isn't global and it isn't regional.
Let's talk about some of the specific places you went. I mean, you say, okay, the art scene in Beijing is really different from that in Cairo. What's the art scene in Beijing like?
Let's see. Well, over the past 2 years, I've been going there frequently, about every 6 weeks or so, working on a project. And we've been reading in the newspapers and magazines this huge art scene in Beijing and record prices being received for Chinese contemporary art, and that's all true. The art market in Beijing is huge. It's when you go through the 798 Gallery District, it's like walking through Chelsea. Big concrete industrial spaces, everything looks as it should.
And are they like former factories the way they are?
That lovely Soho template is all around the world. Yeah. However, in China, being an artist has become an option, a viable career for someone to sustain a living. What goes hand in hand with the tradition of China as a developing country, and that, of course, is debatable, but nonetheless, the art market and art world there is rather new. There's a prevailing energy of marketplace. So many of the artists are quite consumed with selling art. Naturally, this way they can survive as opposed to working in a factory or an office. But what goes hand in hand with that, I think, is a watering down of content, less of a challenge for the artists to inspire themselves and learn from their own art. And of course, then that translates into the experience for the viewer. And so there are a lot of galleries, and they look beautiful and professional, but it's not as easy to find an artist who's doing interesting, sincere work for themselves, which then, of course, gives me a real experience.
It's interesting because one wonders what the art market is. I mean, who is buying in Beijing and what do they want? Is that different from a place like New York, let's say?
I think so. It's changing, of course. And in China, things change every day. I mean, you could go down the street and a week later there's a 20-story high-rise building almost done. But within the art market, I think the earliest of collectors were foreigners, of course. Those who were expats or embassy workers or even the occasional cultural tourists going there to look at things. Now, of course, since the hype of the contemporary Chinese art market, I think more people are going there. Dealers might be going there to discover artists to bring back to whichever cities they reside in. And the market is opening up to a little more of an international market. I do know, though, that it has not been until recently that the Chinese actually have been collecting contemporary art. It really has been for the foreigners. And in fact, when you go through those galleries, at least half of the art will have a red star or some image of Mao or something that represents in a very stylized way what China represents. So it's like looking at New Mexican art that has a cactus or a coyote in it. So I don't know how that transcends into the international contemporary world or at what level. But the Chinese are quite aware of their audience and their market. And of course, like Xixing, who's in this biennial, he's an artist who's not interested in marketplace. He's an artist interested in ideas, social critique, where his government has placed him as an artist, what his future is, and how he fits within a global world. And I think he's addressing real art issues.
Tell us a little bit about his contribution. I know that one of the things you did was you set up collaborations.
Well, I set up collaboration as a theme for the biennial. And unlike the Snow Show, where it was a very fixed collaboration of one artist partner with an architect, in this case, I invited all 25 artists to determine how they may collaborate. If they had decided, which they did not, to collaborate as one giant group and do a work of art, that would have been acceptable. But what ended up happening was each of the artists developed their own project. So there are 18 highly ambitious and demanding projects that will create the total of the biennial. However, the collaboration took place in how the artists interacted with each other. So all of a sudden, there was this unbelievable synergy of, let's say, artist A was doing a project but would speak with artist B and Z and D, and all of a sudden, they would see how their works related. Or they might also dialogue with the artist that had spaces adjacent to them or might relate to sound or what have you. So there was an overall sense of community and collaboration, but not within the development of each individual work, which I'm very pleased with. So a great community, I think, has emerged with the beginning of Site Santa Fe itself and its incredible staff and leadership. And the artists still were able to retain their own voice. So it's almost like a chorus. So everyone has their voice, but in unison, hopefully a larger message will come out from lucky number seven. In the example of Shisheng, he was very easy to embrace another tenet of the biennial, which was ephemerality. The issue of ephemerality for me wasn't so that the artist would make a piece that was about the marketplace or anti-market. In fact, it was quite the opposite. What I felt was that the artist would maybe take a risk, or they might embrace Santa Fe as a source material because it's not something that they're traditionally used to as far as their approach, their method, or their material. So what Shisheng understood during his week-long period here in January was the many layers and a quite complex history of Santa Fe of the people, right? So, of course, there are Native Americans, Hispanics, Anglo, newer immigrants from Mexico, and all around the world are here. But it's this layered aspect of who resides here, who's a native. And he, coming from Mongolia, also realized that when they were occupied and colonized by China, one aspect of their culture which could not be changed, unlike sometimes religion or marriage or dress or religion, if I may have said that already, was food. That's something that physically you cannot impose upon a culture. In fact, in China, there are areas where there are no cows, right? So the people from that region are highly allergic to dairy products. Right. So they're lactose intolerant. And therefore, they have rice products. Whereas other parts of China have cows and cheese. And in fact, physically, their bodies are quite different too. So you have, you know, a huge range of physical looks. So he wanted to use food as a vehicle of talking about colonization. And so for his project, he's brought a chef from Mongolia, a very accomplished chef from Mongolia. This is his first trip to the USA, and in fact, getting the visa was quite a complicated issue. And he just completed a very private action, which will be part of the installation in Santa Fe, which will be located in the kitchen of Site Santa Fe, where he's documented a very private meal where the Mongolian chef went to an individual residence on the Taos Pueblo. And as a cultural exchange, they made a meal. They basically made a Mongolian meal without electricity, without the modern conveniences, and they talked about their cultures and their lifestyles and their dreams, just like any other kind of dialogue, but from two very different cultures. And that will be shared through his installation at site. On the other hand, he'll do a performative work at the biennial, which is a Mongolian blessing, which will essentially launch the biennial and also hopefully take it outside of just the contemporary art world or Santa Fe, but something that's, again, more utopian, and that's about inclusion.
We're talking to Lance Fung. He is the curator of Site Santa Fe's biennial exhibition, Lucky Number 7. It's funny. In thinking about art, I sometimes compare, you know, a biennial like this in my head to a music festival. So if you go to a music festival, bluegrass or salsa or neo-grunge or whatever, people are getting off. And you can really tell whether an artist succeeds or fails by the audience reaction, which is very strong and very obvious. How can you tell or how do you monitor your relationship, not with other artists or and the art world, but with the people for an exhibition like this?
Well, you know, I think that's a perfect observation. However, most people don't see biennials that way. You do, and maybe it's because you've studied the catalog for Lucky Number 7. I think most people view a biennial as a big group show, which it is, and an expensive one at that. And so people go through, and it can be an intellectual project like Rob Storrs, or it could be an experiential show like Klaus Ottmann's. But essentially, it's an exhibition, and the experience is a little more cerebral. And it could be visceral, too, but it isn't quite a reactionary experience as you're explaining with a concert or a performance or the opera. But you're right. You hit it the nail on the head with Lucky Number 7. It's all about this kind of energized reaction the whole biennial for me is about experience, but it's not limited only to the experience of the site staff and the artists and myself, but it's the viewer's experience. And I think you can just feel the vibe. I mean, it sounds touchy-feely, but the truth is...
Not around here.
Maybe not. There are over 100 people working to install this biennial. There are 30-some-odd MFA students from around the country. There are over 60 local artists that are volunteering, and the energy is infectious in there. And I would love the audience to feel and see it now, but of course it's like chaos. However, I honestly believe and know with this biennial that all of that energy is encapsulated in the projects. Another aspect of the biennial, which was a little elliptical, was that the artists had to make the art themselves. You know, I understand when artists need to have works fabricated. Don Judd's work needed to be fabricated. But since the artists are emerging, there's no reason why they can't make their own art, right? You go to Beijing again. I'll pull right back to that.
When you say emerging, you mean not famous artists.
Yeah, and they've been in biennials, and they're known in their countries, but they're not, you know, household names in New York, let's say, right? But in China, there'll be artists that are emerging, 20, 30-year-old, or what have you, and they'll have up to 40 studio assistants. So they barely touch the canvas or the clay or whatever they're making.
And it's like the Renaissance or something.
Renaissance, yeah, Korean factory may be more appropriate.
Yeah.
And I do think that if you look at this phone I'm touching right here, there's no energy in it because it's been made. It's just assembly line. But if you look at the catalog and you get a sense that these are artists' contributions, there is something that is conveyed. There's something like the Lightning Fields or the Duan Light Sanctuary that you can't fake. And the handmade, I think, adds to that experience at least.
I would like to say that the catalog is super cool because it has spongy, what is the material on the cover?
It's kind of a foam.
It's a foam cover.
Yeah. And did you notice the magnets on
the back? There's two volumes, and so they stick together with magnets when you get them both. And the second one hasn't come out yet because it's going to include the work that is still being photographed.
Absolutely.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
And the work that's in the current catalog that is already out, it's sort of each one of them that of the artist's contributions is in itself a little artwork.
Exactly. So rather than doing a standard exhibition catalog where you have the artist's previous works and their exhibition history, provenance, collections, and what have you, which is almost like an auction catalog, I really wanted this first book to be about process and community. So there are lots of pictures of the artists. And the artistic contributions are artworks. So the artists literally conceive them as artist pages. The second book, as you mentioned, which will be attached by magnet, again, the sort of this metaphor of pulling people together here into Santa Fe, will definitely have images of the completed works.
Now, one thing that is happening inside of the site Santa Fe space is that some architects created this ramp system that the artists in their work are responding to because it sort of zigzags throughout the space.
The design was by Todd Williams and Billy Chen, fantastic architects based in New York. And it came about early on when I asked them to do the exhibition design, and I said, could you do a walking roller coaster? And in fact, they did a more elegant version of that. There are no curves. It's quite linear. But the idea was for the artists who may not be inspired by Santa Fe history or landscape or the institutional partners that we have for locations, but who might really be looking at it in a very formal way, I wanted to give them a unique architectural experience so that they could do a piece where people could look up at their work or look down. It also allows the audience to have a different experience. I think you need to see the show like three ways. Up the ramp, ground floor right, ground floor left. I mean, most people who have been in so far from Santa Fe say, I cannot even recognize this space. And I think that topsy-turvy is a good thing.
And you have to, if you look at it, if you go up, then you'll see all different pieces, and you'll see them in different ways coming back down.
Absolutely.
So some of the work is also off-site.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tell us about that, how that came to being and what some of these works are.
Well, again, in January when the artists came here to find their inspiration, Shisheng found it with this issue of colonization and used the vehicle of food for his work. Others found physical locations that were their point of inspiration. Some found museum spaces and based on their collection that would be the appropriate context for their work. Toronto, there's a great project essentially made by local artists under the direction of Fuji-san, our artist from Japan, that is at the Opera House. So Sighted collected plastic water bottles for months on end. And the local artists...
No shortage of those.
No shortage of those, but we did use up a bunch. And I guess there's about 30 local artists came and committed their time and created these sculptures, which are almost like chandeliers, which are installed on the lampposts of the upper parking lot of the opera. And so they're sculptural by day, and certainly when they're illuminated, when people leave the opera, they'll turn plastic into glass or crystal and stained glass, and it's really an extraordinary piece.
Are they up yet?
They are, in fact. Yeah.
And so anybody who goes to the opera will have the ability to see them.
Yeah, and it was really a generous act of Richard Gaddis to allow us to do it and to have no issues of editing or control. He believed in the process and was excited by the proposal, and now it's up.
There are some other off-site pieces as well.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about them.
There are a number. Let's see, where do I start? Nick Mangan, the artist from Australia, is doing... He found a perfect location on Aldo Street. Aldo or Alto, I'm not sure. And it's A1 Stone Factory. And he's created a piece that's like an archaeological dig. It's unbelievably convincing. But again, what he was interested in was doing a dig in which he was unveiling the various histories, biases, and cultures of Santa Fe, which there are many.
Now he's actually digging down into the dirt.
Yeah.
In real life. Okay.
It's completed as well. Marty Anson from Spain used a local story in his hometown outside of Barcelona as the concept of his work. It was really nonsensical. Essentially, the town owned a factory, and they sold it to a developer who wanted to turn it into a shopping mall. The townies, of course, did not want to remove this historic building, so the city board or whatever came up with many proposals which were even more outlandish than the next and actually were like conceptual art. Basically, they wanted to rebuild the building across the street as a replica, just to appease the people but still cash in on selling the property so a shopping mall could go there. So in the tradition of Americans bringing buildings from Europe over, like the Tower Bridge and, you know, what have you, he decided to make a 1/12 scale replica of that building on Museum Hill. It's up there now. It's extraordinary. It is a cross between kitsch and very conceptual, surreal sculpture. The facade is decorated beautifully, yet the interior and two side walls are raw brick. So you really get a sense that it's not functional building, it's art. At the same token, the issue of ephemerality came up with the biennial, because, as I've stated, no artwork should remain past the close of the biennial of January 4th. And so we discussed it at length, and we realized...
You and the artists.
Of course, yeah. And with Marty's case, Marty said, you know, it's certainly up to the city to decide what will happen with it. But if the city would like to retain that building, of course it ceases to exist as a work of art at the end of the biennial, and it could become storage or information booth or a toilet, and it's no longer art, but it would be a wonderful physical legacy for Lucky Number 7.
That's very interesting. So art really is in the mind of the beholder rather than in the object.
I think so. And again, for me, if we look through this whole 2-year process of doing this biennial, the art really isn't even on the walls of what you see. For me, and this is, of course, a leap for probably many people, the art has been completely about the process of working with the artists, working with site, meeting with all of the different museum people in town, and being welcomed into this community. And that's what I'll hang on to. And so when the art slowly fades and disappears after January, the real art that I think remains is what's begun. And this is this whole new sense of community that's been developed around a group of artists that didn't know each other, institutions, Site Santa Fe, all the other cultural partners. And to me, that's sort of what is the most important message from the biennial.
Do you think that some of these, for example, collaborations among the artists will continue past the end of the exhibition?
Oh, absolutely. Without a doubt. It's amazing to see their reunion over the past few months, because artists have been here up to 2 months already. And they actually are happy to see the other artist, and you get a sense of familiarity.
Now, is that unusual? I mean, is it usually so competitive?
Not necessarily competitive, but quite often the curator will select the artist, select the works of art, and then everything else is done by the museum, and there's a plan of how things get installed, and things are put up, and the curator comes in for the opening. The curator often has very little interaction with the artist other than the initial meeting and the selection of the work. There might be a few commission-based projects, and the curator or his or her assistant might have more dialogue with the artist. And this one, since it's about community and process, is the opposite. I mean, you cannot imagine how many emails I would get a day. And I spoke with every artist at least daily. And we were really intertwined. And of course, after the biennial, we'll go our ways, but I think many people will retain a dialogue because there's a synergy there.
And all of this is about Site Santa Fe's biennial exhibition. It's called Lucky Number 7, and it opens to the public this Sunday, the 22nd of June, from 12 to 5. That's a free event. There are many more events happening surrounding this exhibition, and people can go to sitesantafe.org for more information, and they can also call 989-1199. Lance Fung is the curator of all of this. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome, joining us by telephone, Paula Faust. She is the producer, director, and co-writer of the film Origins of Yoga, which opens this weekend at the Santa Fe Film Center. It'll be screening on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and Wednesday of next week. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, your film is about the parts of yoga that were actually eliminated to make it palatable to Westerners. Tell us about this.
Well, the truth is that the word yoga means to yoke or union between your soul and the divine. And the physical asanas that are taught in the West are just one part of yoga.
And the other parts are very much brought out in this film, and some of them are quite amazing. There's one of the yogis who talks about an initiation ritual in which he died symbolically and all ties were severed to enter the yogic life.
Yes, that's absolutely true. What the yogis do when they first begin the path, when they first enter the path of yoga, is they give up their names and they give up everything they had as a regular human being up until that point. And they absolutely, totally perform their own funeral rites. And from that point anew, they have a new name. They shave their heads, which is also symbolic of surrender. And then they totally give themselves over to God in every way, give themselves over to the divine. So it's as if they begin a new life, a new rebirth at that point. And their new name is known as their Yogpat, or their name of yoga.
And so it's when we think of people who are born again, this is more dramatic than probably most versions of that we know in say Christian religion.
It's very dramatic because what they do is they leave everything. In other words, your family, your business, you walk away from everything, and all you have is pretty much two changes of clothing, and you go barefoot and you leave society. And they generally wander around so that they don't become attached and traditionally wouldn't stay in any place for more than 3 days. So it's quite a severe path.
What they do is some of them sing, they chant, they meditate, they get closer and closer to God. They talk about what I guess we would call, or they would call, nirvanic experiences. And they also serve the communities in which they live or through which they pass.
That's true. Traditionally, much as the shamans would serve communities in the olden days or in societies that are closer to the earth, in India, a yogi traditionally will serve much in the same way a priest would. You know, they don't really have confession per se, but they certainly speak with everyone on spiritual matters, on religious matters, and they kind of hold that space for the community, even though some of them are living out on the street. But they also are regarded in India as someone with whom you can practice giving, you can practice charity, because, you know, yogis are like wandering monks. So people will bring them food or money, you know, things that will help them, because they're pretty much just relying on society to be taken care of.
And so would you say that in the places you were, they were accepted by the communities in which they were living?
They are very much accepted, because they go back about at least 5,000 years, if not 7,000 years even. And the original great sages that lived in the caves that left society, they wrote the books, they wrote the scriptures that today Hinduism is based on. And then Buddha also was a yogi. He studied with all the greatest yogis of his time and surpassed them. And then, of course, you know, Buddhism grew out of his teachings. And even Jesus Christ lived in a manner that was quite similar to the yogis, by staying in silence, by going and praying for 40 days and nights, fasting. A lot of these practices of purification, they go way back to the Hindu yogis. So it's quite interesting, the similarities.
How did you come to make this film?
I began to spend a lot of time in India and Nepal and the Himalayas when I was 19 years old. I was sent there to study by my university, which was Pitzer College at the Claremont Colleges. And I saw these very interesting characters out on the streets and in the temples living around in Nepal and India. And they were just very open and very friendly, and they loved to share their faith with others. So I was always quite fascinated by religions, and I got to study with them. First, I wrote a book on the yogis, which was published back in the 80s. It's called Shiva. It's a colorful, you know, photographic color plate book on the path of yoga. And then I decided to make a film about them, so it was quite exciting.
How did you find the yogis that you interviewed and whom you filmed?
We went to areas that we knew are places of pilgrimage, because the yogis traditionally, for thousands of years, followed these certain pilgrimage paths throughout the Himalayas and throughout the subcontinent of India. So by going to holy places such as Varanasi, which is the oldest continuously existing city on earth, and it's just lined with many, many temples and many sacred spots, it's a place where yogis will go, and also most pious Hindus will go, because they believe to be cremated there will speed them on to a very, you know, better rebirth. So by going to areas that are considered sacred to them, you can usually find a great deal of yogis. And also, if you go to festivals, certain festivals that are sacred to them.
There was one yogi in the film who said, stay away from fake yogis. How do you, as a filmmaker, discern who's fake and who's real?
That's a very good question. Yes, there are a lot of fake charlatans, because in India, they say there's about 13 million yogis, because the population there is about 1.1 to 1.2 billion people. So you can generally tell if they're just talking about money, or they're staring at your wristwatch, or asking you for something, you know, in a way that doesn't seem very authentic. A lot of yogis will just hang around, particularly tourists, but I don't consider them real yogis. They're just people dressed up as a yogi that are begging, you know, to make a living.
Or undressed up, one might say. They're practically naked.
Yeah, some of them are. Some of them are naked, and wearing ashes to protect their skin from the sun and the elements.
The yogis whom you filmed, how did they feel about being in the film? What was their relationship to it?
You know, the main yogi in Origins of Yoga, Swami Vidyanand Swarup, Brahmachari, we found him literally on the roadside sitting in a tea shop. And it was quite interesting how we found him, because he was just absolutely perfect. It seemed like central casting had dropped him down from the sky, you know, on a cloud and said,
right.
Here's your perfect yogi. I mean, he just looks fantastic.
Yeah.
And he was so peaceful and so wonderful. He never wanted anything. If you tried to give him a little money or we went and bought him a new shawl, and he didn't want anything from us. And what he said really was he wanted Westerners to know about their path to God. So they were very happy. He in particular was very happy that we were making this film, and he would do anything to help us. And he'd never even been in a hotel before, and we got a hotel room. We put him in there, and then we went down at night before dinner to see him, and he was there doing a big kind of meditation and ceremony, and he had us all come in and be with him as he did it. And it was so wonderful. He just sanctified the atmosphere, and it was quite charming because he's sitting on the floor. He wasn't used to a bed or anything like that. So he got right on the floor.
And so the idea from him was just let more people know about this in order to inspire and educate them?
Absolutely, yes. He was very, very happy we were doing it. And he went up with us to Rotong Pass, which is a pass in the Himalayas, which goes from Manali up towards Ladakh, the area known as Little Tibet. And we went up there. It was so cold and very, very windy, and he never complained, you know, completely barefoot and wearing very little, you know, just very thin cloth. And we were freezing. All of us were freezing. We had down jackets and thermal underwear. You know.
Right.
Shawls and hats and gloves, you know, all the usual things we have, mufflers. And he just had this very thin piece of cloth on.
Now, did they, for somebody like him, for example, is it that he's not complaining, or is it he's got special ways of actually regulating his body's temperature and functions?
I think they're used to hardship, and then also some of them, the ones that really are, you know, further along the path, actually can regulate themselves and can deal with a lot of discomfort. And normally we can't, but what you're talking about, I think, is true. Some of them can actually do that.
What were you looking for when you started making this film?
When I first had gone over to Nepal and India, and I was very young, I was quite fascinated with the so-called holy men or holy women. And I think I was just looking to experience them and to experience their way of life. And I actually got to live some time with them, traveling, sleeping in a cave. And their lifestyle was quite magical. It felt very freeing to live without anything. Although, of course, I always had a passport and I could get on a plane and fly home again, you know, which is something they can't do. But they don't have a home to fly to, for one thing. But just that very freeing quality when you're dependent on God, you're dependent on the divine. So it just sort of doesn't, you know, you can't control anything. Doesn't matter what happens because you're giving it all up.
And that's the way they live from day to day. They're not controlling anything. They've given it all up. And they're very happy in a way that when I was watching the film and I was sort of trying to put myself into their place, it's almost unimaginable.
It is, because our society is the polar opposite of that. We
yeah.
want to feel secure all the time. And everyone here, we're kind of used to, you know, having another television set or, okay, now it has to be a flat screen. And, you know, society keeps marching along, development and all of these things, all of these luxuries. We don't regard them as luxuries. We're used to it. But people in, as we call them, third world countries or underdeveloped countries, they're not used to all of the things we have. And quite often they don't have electricity. They don't have water. And here, I remember years ago, one time I was in Los Angeles and the electricity went out in one area and some people just couldn't deal with it. It was a big, you know, that was a big difference from their normal way of living. So everything here, you know, we're kind of pampered and protected.
Yeah, I often wonder if we had a Great Depression the way they had in 1929 and past that in this country, we're so much more spoiled than we were then. We'd have to start taking a page out of the Yogi's book if we're not already doing it.
Yes, I think that's quite true. So, you know, when you don't have so many protective things kind of keeping you from feeling, you know, hot and cold and all these things that in a normal everyday life, at least I'm not talking about a, you know, life out in the countryside, but an urban lifestyle, we don't even have as much nature in some of our cities because we have so much cement or we have so many huge buildings and elevators and all of these things that the undeveloped societies aren't used to. So when all of that is taken away and you're kind of back to an old-fashioned way of living, I think you're just more in touch with nature, more in touch with your own self.
We're talking to Paula Faust about the film Origins of Yoga, which is opening this weekend at the Santa Fe Film Center. I noticed that there weren't any women yogis. What's up with that?
You know, so many people ask us that, and there was no intention behind that. What happened was just female yogis are more unusual because it is difficult for them to leave society and to be out living on the street. We did do another film called Naked in Ashes, and there are some females in that film.
I just wondered whether there weren't any.
There are some. There's not as many, but there are some.
Did you see any Westerners or any non-Indian people who were walking this path in a very serious way, the way that those yogis were?
Yes, there are. And as a matter of fact, there were a few female yogis that were Westerners. One in particular from Sweden, I saw her many years ago, and she was unbelievable. All of the local people pretty much regarded her as a saint. They'd sit around her, and they had just so much devotion for her and so much respect, because she truly was practicing that lifestyle, and she had really come a long way in her consciousness. She really had understood, you know, the truth of the path of yoga.
Some of the people who you talked about in the film, or who were talked about in the film, were people who barely ate and drank, and some people just lived on oxygen, on air. I've heard about breatharians and people who don't eat. How do you verify that that's true?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I know that in Yogananda's book, Autobiography of a Yogi, many, many years ago, he wrote about Ananda Mai Ma, who was a female saint, and her devotees used to give her one grain of rice three times a day. And I met her several times. And I certainly could feel a lot in her presence, but to verify it, you would actually have to stay with them, you know, all the time and watch them. But I know in the case of one yogi in particular who was in India, that scientists had come and had measured his breathing and measured his heart and his brain waves and done a lot of those tests. So nowadays, there are times when scientists will test certain people's brain waves, you know, if they're in the state of samadhi, and compare them and things like that. There has been research done, although it's not common, but there has been some done.
The film is called Origins of Yoga. So let's talk about those origins. What do we actually know about how the lineages have come down over all these millennia? Is it in scripture and oral tradition?
Yes, it is. It is in scripture and it is in oral. And many, many years ago, they say 5,000 to perhaps even as old as 7,000 years ago, that the Vedas and the Upanishads, the very ancient scriptures, were written by people who traditionally left society and went away to be alone, to be in caves, and they would examine the age-old questions. They would ponder things such as, why are we here? What will happen to us when we die? You know, what happens when I no longer have a body? Do I have a soul? Do I have a spirit? So these kind of questions, they thought about them, they meditated, and they came up with some answers and some techniques, and these have been passed down. And they formed the body of what is known as yoga.
Now, how did it affect you and the other people who were making the film in the long run? When you came back, did you feel that it had affected you on some other levels?
I've spent a lot of time with these type of people in the Far East, so it has affected me very profoundly throughout my life. The yogis, definitely. It's just such a wonderful feeling when you're with them. It's a feeling of love. It's a feeling of compassion, understanding, and it's something you just cherish. It's a very, very special feeling, and it did affect all of us. Our film crew was very happy, and they all want to go back to India as often as they can.
Oh, that's so interesting. There was one moment in the film where they were saying that for the yogis, all actions are sacred, whether they be cooking or bathing. Everything is in the path, and I wondered if that applied to regular old non-yogi people.
Ultimately, it should apply to all of us because, yes, what it means is just that everything we're doing consciously, not unconsciously. We're using everything we do as a remembrance of the divine, whatever name you want to give God. So many religions give God different names. But, yes, as we evolve as human beings, everything should be done, you know, in that same spirit, the spirit of oneness, the spirit of compassion.
We're talking to Paula Faust, producer and director of Origins of Yoga. What is next on your filmmaking agenda? Are you going to follow up on this theme? I know you've done, well, as you said, you've done a lot of work in India.
Yes, we've done Naked and Active, and we finished a film recently called Not in God's Name, which is... It has the leaders of many, many faiths talking about not killing in the name of God and examining why do people kill in the name of God. And the lead person in that film is His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And right now we've just begun another film, which is about the gypsies. The original gypsies started in Western India, in Rajasthan, with the music and the dance. And they followed the armies across the continents over to Europe. They were metal workers, and they used to follow them because they would sharpen the swords as they traveled along with the armies. So we're making a film on that right now.
Oh, I wanted to ask you one more thing. There was a person in your film, a professor named Georg Feuerstein, a German. How did you come to work with him?
Oh, he's fantastic. Georg Feuerstein, he is the world's leading authority on yoga. He's written about 40 books on it. And I came to know him just by reading yoga magazines and, I think, researching on the subject. He's just a remarkable person. And he's so knowledgeable, and he truly lives it. I mean, in his presence, you feel very blessed and, you know, quite happy just to be around him, actually. He is wonderful, and I think a lot of films and a lot of books, if you read up, you'll notice that a lot of authors are quoting him and the great research and work that he's done on yoga.
Paula Faust is director, producer, and co-writer of the film Origins of Yoga, which opens at the Santa Fe Film Center this weekend, Saturday at 2:30 and Sunday at 2:30, and you can check their website and the paper for more information on that. You can also go to originsofyoga.com. And the film Naked and Ashes is also coming up, so we'll have to check up on that too, which is coming up a little bit later in this summer. Paula Faust, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, Good Morning Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Bacon Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.